Hey, folks, next up on This Week in Law, Micah Escano, Franklin Graves, and Mike Keyes join me. I'm Denise Howell. We're going to talk Pokemon Go law and AR law, a bit about YouTube fan subs, also YouTube advertising boycotts, and how YouTube's going to deal with the conflict between advertisers on the one hand and free-ranging content creators on the other. And of course, this week being the week that it is, we're going to spend a good deal of time on the Fyre Festival, what you need to know as a marketer and what you need to know as an online influencer to not have your face in your palms or other people's faces in theirs when they look at your actions online. All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 385, recorded May 5th, 2017. Hashtag I am a shill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so glad you've been able to make the time to join us here, where we are going to discuss at length, as we generally do, interesting issues at the intersection of technology and law. We've got a great panel of folks to do that with today. My co-host Mike Keyes is back. Hello, Mike. Great to see you.
Denise, great to be here. Great to see you. Sorry I missed last week, but happy to be here today.
Great to have you back. Matt Curtis, for those of you who are looking around for him going, where's Matt? Matt's, I believe, taking a test today. So he is off and will be back shortly. And as long as we're doing programming notes, we will be off next week on May 12th. So we'll skip next week, but be back at it the week after that. And our panel today includes our very first ever intern with the show, Franklin Graves, who has long since graduated from our midst and is practicing law himself, has been for some time, out in Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee, right, Franklin?
Yes, that's correct. Thanks for having me again. It's great to be on. I think it was 5 or 6, maybe this summer it was 6 years ago that I was an intern. It's insane, but yes.
You broke ground for, and no one's ever quite been able to fill those great big shoes that you left. Franklin, thank you. Yes, as we go through our show today, Franklin is responsible for much of what we do and how we do it, for helping me out that summer that he was an intern. So it's wonderful to have you back on the show, and just great to reconnect and touch base with you, Franklin. And Franklin has a friend who we haven't had on the show before, but who is a lawyer and a consultant to law firms in all things that make them fast, efficient, and otherwise provide goodness to how they deliver their legal services. And that's Micah Escano, and he's joining us today as well. Hello, Micah.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's really great to have you, Micah. Great to meet you. And we have some really fun stuff to discuss this week. Lots of things relating to advertising this week, of all things. So let's get into it and talk about the social web. So between our last show and the show that we're doing this week, news has broken of a festival in the Bahamas that did not go as planned. The Fyre Festival would have been fun to attend, I think, had it been as marketed. But that was its whole big problem, is that I'm sure this has been all over the news. If you've been under a rock somewhere, I will give you just a bit of context to let you know that rapper Ja Rule and an organizer whose name is escaping me right now. I want to call him Billy Banks, but I don't think that's it. In any event, I'm sure IRC will correct me and let me know the name. In any event, these folks had never put on a concert before, but decided that they would raise a bunch of money and try to put on this very elite remote on a Bahamian island event that was going to be 2 weekends long and sort of in the tradition of Coachella with hip hot trendy bands and hip hot trendy people in attendance, and did this huge marketing campaign of consisting mainly of models on boats in the Bahamas and frolicking and having fun and making it look like, gee, why wouldn't you want to be at the Fyre Festival and enjoy this lifestyle for a couple of weekends? So a bunch of people shelled out a bunch of money. Some of them actually were flown to the location, which was not the represented location, apparently, according to the various lawsuits that have ensued in the wake of all this. And had a miserable, you know, I know everyone on the internet is just crying huge sad tears for the tragedy that all of the would-be Fyre Festival attendees had to go through. But the fact is, you know, however little sympathy you might have for people who followed the marketing and tried to have this experience, they really did get kind of hosed over. They spent a bunch of money and nothing that they were promised was delivered, except for apparently there was an open bar that they tried to appease people with until that just wouldn't accommodate them anymore and they had to find a place to sleep. So I you know, I'll leave you to further investigate all the details of the Fyre Festival gone wrong and the tragic experiences that folks have gone through. Or you could read the lawsuit complaints, which are detailing those, you know, what they were promised and what they actually experienced, pursuing legal redress for that. But for our purposes here on This Week in Law, I find this whole debacle fascinating because of the way it was marketed, the very effective way it was marketed. They enticed a lot of people into plunking down a lot of money to attend a very untested event, thinking that, you know, oh, we'll be right at the cutting edge of this. And apparently, you know, they just got taken in by the fact that photographs and photographs from particularly influential people posted to their accounts and not disclosed as advertising can be very effective. And the FTC, as we've discussed for years on the show, ever since they announced that they were going to pay attention to this issue, has guidelines that limit how people can promote things that they are affiliated with and being paid for in one way or another, compensated for in one way or another. Here, the Fyre Festival had 400 online influencers, a lot of models, a lot of other people who just happened to have huge followings on places like Instagram that they partnered with and promised, hey, you know, you're going to come and have this amazing experience too. And some of that happened beforehand so they could have all these glossy photos of folks to pass around and promote the event that did not happen. And I believe one of those 400 influencers that were enlisted to help make this a truly memorable event, or at least bring in a lot of money and get people to pay that money, only one of them did the recommended FTC procedure and posted hashtag ad at the beginning of her post about, you know, posting a photo of herself frolicking in the Bahamas. So that's a real issue. And apparently there's an enormous disconnect still between people who are making money off their Instagram accounts and what the law and the FTC in particular expects of them in the country. So there have been lawsuits filed. I'm a little bit confused as I go through the coverage. Rolling Stone is talking about 3 lawsuits filed. I've only seen the complaints. Well, I've only seen the complaint in one of them, but Rolling Stone claims to have the complaint in 2. So far, I know for sure that there's a lawsuit pending in Los Angeles and a lawsuit pending in New York. And as I said, Rolling Stone is talking about a 3rd pending somewhere. It may be I'm thinking maybe it was an amendment to the Los Angeles one, perhaps, but I'm sure that'll all fall into place as this unfolds. But the people being pursued are the promoters. The chief marketing director is also a named defendant in the New York lawsuit, they are all being cast as class actions so that anyone who bought a ticket to this thing or God forbid actually flew out there can start to be reimbursed. But it's a little bit uncertain whether any of them will be certified as a class action. The court has to approve that. And if different people were injured in different ways, they may wind up having to bring their own individual lawsuits against these folks if they're determined to pursue them. But the interesting thing too, again, for our purposes on the show, is what you can do in lawsuits if you don't know the names of all the defendants right at the beginning, you have some leeway, or you just don't want to name them right at the beginning, you have some leeway to add them into the lawsuit later. And one gets the feeling that that's what's going to happen with the, at least the Los Angeles lawsuit and possibly the New York one, whatever one is, whatever other one might be pending too, as the Doe defendants. If you ever see a complaint and you see that various Does have been sued, those are people that defendants to be named later. So it's certainly feasible, and I would be actually surprised if a number of these influencers, these 400 influencers, didn't get added into the lawsuit as well for having misled people and failed to comply with the FTC guidelines. And of course, the FTC has something to say about that too. As far as we know, the FTC has not commented yet on this incident, although in recent months, they have been paying attention to and issuing further guidances, sending direct letters to influencers they don't feel are complying with their rules, and reminding people, as they've done over the years since their guidelines first went into effect, that you can't just bury your disclosure in a series of hashtags at the end of the post. It has to be at the beginning of the post so that it will be understood. And you can't use things like hashtag partner, because that's too vague to convey what's actually going on here. The only thing we know for sure, well, the FTC hasn't even said that this would fly for sure, but they have several times said that if you put hashtag AD at the beginning of a post like this, you're probably going to be okay. Likely be effective is the language that the FTC has used. So Mike, did you watch all this unfold with the same amount of facepalming as I and the rest of the internet did?
I did. I was blown away by the various news accounts, not only from the marketing perspective, but then exactly what happened when people were on site and how it was just a complete and total disaster. Lots of potential issues here from a legal perspective. As you pointed out, Denise, there apparently are three different lawsuits. You know, the influencer angle is a very hot area right now that the FTC is watching like a hawk. And the reason being, as we've talked about before, is when you've got influencers out there that are peddling products or services for a third party, if there's a material connection between that influencer and the brand, that needs to be conspicuously and clearly disclosed, that material connection. So it's clear to consumers that this particular influencer is being compensated in some form or fashion. So you can assess the situation as a consumer and decide how much weight or influence or persuasiveness you want to attribute to that particular influencer. So, as you noted, there's 400 fire starters here. I would imagine that many of them will ultimately be named in the lawsuit. You mentioned the Doe process that has been invoked. So it'll be interesting. Of course, influencers could potentially be liable, and liability can clearly trickle down to the brand as well, or the promoters or producers of this particular show. Should also point out that, you know, the FTC, the guidelines are pretty specific that you, as a brand or a promoter, you are responsible for the acts of your influencers. So it's a fairly perilous situation here. You've got to, from a regulatory legal compliance perspective, you got to keep control on your influencers and be watching what they're doing quite carefully. So this is going to be fascinating to see how this all plays out.
Now, these FTC guidelines have been in effect for several years. I forget exactly how many now, but we've certainly talked about them on the show over the years. And I'm trying to get my handle around, I remember back when they first were implemented, being somewhat staggered at the fact that I think fines of $10,000 per violation for influencers, but the people actually posting. That number sticks in my head, but I haven't checked it again before the show. And I know that over the years, the FTC has certainly hit the people hiring the influencers for huge numbers. There was a $40 million settlement involving Lunada Biomedical and a $250,000 fine for something called legacy learning systems for not having adequate disclosure in their affiliates' reviews of products. So certainly in going after the people hiring the influencers, I don't know what we want to call them, people with these brilliant marketing strategies, the FTC has shown that they will definitely speak loudly with their fines. And I guess that we've seen fines in the thousands of dollars so far for various people who've been unaware of their obligations. And the reason I think this resonates with me so much is we've been talking about it for so many years, and I think that people are still completely in the dark as to what they're supposed to be doing, and that, you know, they're kind of a deer in the headlights when somebody comes to them, like these Fire Festival promoters. And now, I'm not calling Kendall Jenner a deer in the headlights, okay? But they brought in 400 people, and you would imagine that of those 400, some of them don't have legal staffs on retainer, and, you know, are just, you know, happy to be approached and just happen to have huge Instagram followings for whatever reason, whether, you know, I don't want to go into their and I can't go into their various motivations and methods. Maybe some of them are just really good photographers, right? And so for someone like that to get some recognition that, hey, you know, we like what you're doing, we think you could, you know, definitely help our brand, and we'd like to pay you for being involved in this thing that we're planning that's going to be fun and interesting, they might just, you know, I just am suspecting there's some naivete there that needs to get chased out. And it's been several years now, and it seems like it hasn't gotten chased out. Franklin, what do you think of all this?
The first time I actually heard about the whole Fire Festival debacle was, I think it was right after it was happening, or right as it was happening. It was one of my favorite tweets. It's from Christina Warren. She tweeted out, all she tweeted was the ball pit photo from DashCon in 2014. And if you're familiar with your internet memes at all, that might mean something to you. But it was just hysterical to me how disorganized this was, and how it's definitely a lesson to learn for any conference or festival organizers, for sure. And you mentioned Kendall Jenner, and I just feel so sorry for her recently, because she had the Pepsi ad that came out that was pushed aside for a little while by the United Flight video. And then now she follows it up with this whole Fire Festival debacle being involved in it. So she just can't seem to catch a break, poor thing. But one of the issues that I kind of think is really important to talk about here, especially from a legal perspective, are the insurance issues. So if you look at the complaint that was filed, the one that you point to, it looks like there's a Delaware entity that's established, Fire Media Inc. So one of the questions that I have is whether they have insurance coverage that specifically for concert or festival promoters. And the reason why that is so, like, relevant and on my mind, and it was one of the first things I thought about, was because if you remember back to, I think it was 2011, the music industry kind of, there were shockwaves sent throughout when the horrible incident happened at the Indiana State Fair, where the stage collapsed and people were killed. It was because of the wind. And we probably talked about it on this show. But the promoters that were involved, like Live Nation and even the country music band Sugarland and other parties, they were brought into a whole legal mess as a result of that. But it ended up settling in 2014. So that was a huge learning curve for the music industry in terms of making sure that insurance is, first of all, insurance is in place, and then documents are properly signed by all the parties involved. And, you know, you have clearly defined who is liable for instances like this. So I hope that Fyre Festival or the Fyre Media Company had protections from a legal standpoint in line for that. But the fact that their organizers, the actual individuals, are getting dragged into the lawsuit is definitely not a good sign. But yeah, so you mentioned the FTC guidelines as well, and that's something that was on my radar recently as well, because the FTC actually, back at the beginning of April, they released that blog post that kind of got circulated where they detailed that they had sent around those letters to all of the social media influencers or a select group of them. And I love this article in law.com where the reporter, who is the reporter? He did a great job, and I was really excited to see that freedom of information request had been sent. But regardless, a FOIA request was sent, and the names have now been released of all the celebrities that received those warnings about their Instagram posts not being properly sponsored or disclosing the sponsorships on them. So I think there's a lot to learn right now. And if I can give a shout out for a quick second, there's a nonprofit group called the Internet Creators Guild. I'm actually a member of it just because I do my whole YouTube channel and everything. So it's a great resource for that side of things. But they actually do a great job of educating creators about issues such as FTC guidelines. So if there are internet creators that are happen to be listening or you know one, I would definitely share that organization, because as you said, Denise, it's very important to make sure that creators are aware of the issues that they could be potentially facing, from regulatory issues all the way down to just getting help on being a creator and surviving off of that and having a living from that. So shout out to Internet Creators Guild.
Yeah, I'm so glad that they exist for the people that you mentioned who are actually attempting to make their social media or online presence their livelihood. But I remain concerned too about people who just, you know, are that's not their goal. They just happen to have a social media presence, and it happens to be influential as an afterthought. And there are a lot of people like that as well. And even, you know, in the context of watching this all unfold, it occurred to me that I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this. Regular, you know, Joe on the street folks walk into a restaurant or some sort of establishment, and they're asked to provide a positive Yelp review while they're there, or some other kind of review online. And if they do so, they're, I don't know, maybe comped something at the restaurant or given some little tchotchke or something. I think that that totally falls within these FTC disclosure guidelines, or that one Absolutely. Should assume that it does. Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't, you might just go, oh, what a great idea. You know, I'm enjoying my meal. I'll post a positive review and they'll take something off the bill. You can't do that without putting hashtag ad on, or you risk, you know, it's probably highly unlikely that, rank and file citizens who get approached with such a strategy, a marketing strategy, would be pursued by the FTC, but it's totally possible under the guidelines. So people should just be aware of that. Micah, we haven't heard from you yet. What are your thoughts on this whole train wreck?
You know, it's really interesting. I was watching all the comments over the weekend of people responding to this kind of horrible occurrence, there wasn't a lot of sympathy for those as affected. And with that, I kept wondering, while I think there's clearly something that wrong occurred, and there will be people who will be getting in trouble and having financial repercussions over this, I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of punitive damages or even any real major response outside of, you know, refunds, surely because there's not a lot of social outrage about the people who were affected. It's
right.
More of a running joke than it is, oh, we feel bad for these people. Mm-hmm. Now, is that fair? Maybe not. But if this was a different kind of social class of individual where we really felt bad, I think you'd see a lot more punitive damages coming across, a lot more, you know, worrisome outrage. But I think outside of some slaps on the wrist and, you know, refunds, I don't think there's going to be a lot of, you know, anything else other than hand slapping. But in regards to the advertising or lack thereof of notification that's advertising for Instagram and other types of services, well, I don't think the platforms where they posted these pictures are necessarily liable, because they probably have a rule or something in their own acceptance agreements that you need to do that, you know, as well as the FTC. I think from a practical standpoint, those tools themselves to share the pictures and are getting people famous should be taking proactive steps to say, hey, if you do start advertising, if you are compensated, you do need to do these things to stay in compliance. And again, I don't think it's necessarily as a liability thing, but I think it's probably the right thing to do to help individuals who don't have in-house counsel, who aren't well-versed in how they should be doing these things, to keep out of trouble and keep the use of the platform viable going forward. So I think there's some, you know, steps they can take to help mitigate this type of thing happening in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to see that anyone who's engaging in affiliate marketing with influencers gives them, okay, you know, I mean, they, I guess, sort of tread a little dangerously toward giving their affiliates legal advice, but I'm sure they could work around that and just say, hey, you know, you should be aware that there's a legal issue out here, and these are, you know, we have exposure too, and this is how we'd like you to present this kind of post. So that would certainly be a good idea. It's somewhat stunning that of the 400 influencers, you would think that, I hate to keep singling out Kendall Jenner, but you would think that maybe she would be the one, or someone, maybe Gigi or Bella Hadid would be the one who actually had, you know, enough advice from their teams of folks to have them do it the proper way, but none of them did. And maybe it's time to fire Chris. I don't know. But it's
well, Denise, I think if you that law.com article that I mentioned, and I just found that. And Ryan Barber is the person, the journalist who submitted the FOIA request and got the list. But I was kind of surprised at the names of the people on there. It mentions Jennifer Lopez and Snooki from the Jersey Shore back in the day.
Oh, my God.
But Lindsay Lohan, Heidi Klum. I think that all of these people are celebrities that I would expect to have proper counsel, especially when they receive such a significant income from simply tweeting out or Instagramming a photo. It just seems to me like they would at least be educated on the proper ways. And maybe their counsel doesn't fully understand the guidelines because it's just unclear. I'm not sure. So it is, in my opinion, it's helpful to have the article that you sent out and the guidelines clearly disclosed by the FTC and just read, because it really helps you kind of understand if you are advising clients on these issues to just simply read through and make sure that you have a full grasp of all the different technicalities of how these types of posts should be disclosed.
Yes.
You also mentioned, you know, a significant amount of money, but for some of these people, is that amount really significant to them? So, you know, if it's not significant to them, are they really going to run it by their lawyers for, you know, a small fraction of what they make in a day? So I think that's another kind of thing to look at, is I think for a lot of them, it wasn't that big of a deal. It was just a quick thing.
Right. It would be so wonderful if Snooki were the one affiliate person who had gotten it right, crossed all the T's, dotted all the I's. I want to live in that world.
Before we leave this topic, if we were, you know, Franklin had mentioned the issue of insurance. You know, many commercial general liability policies have exclusions for such claims as fraud, breach of contract, and these sorts of things. So to the extent that these lawsuits allege fraud, which I know at least one of them does, claims like that typically wouldn't be covered under a policy. So some of these folks, consumers, may be out of luck if they're looking for a deep pocket insurance company to pay up.
Right. I mean, if you look through all the coverage of the Fyre Festival, there's the one inside article from the person who was working for them a month before everything went down and saw the writing on the wall, saw that they weren't paying the talent. And that's why the bands started backing out. They just weren't getting the checks they'd been promised. So I suspect if there's no insurance, there's probably very little to come after. Franklin mentioned that we have a bunch of stories about this and everything else we're going to discuss today that are all collected for you if you'd like to look at them too. If you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, you'll find our whole list of stories for today under episode 385. And if you're a Flipboard person, just find me. I'm Dee Howell on Flipboard. I have a This Week in Law magazine, and we put everything in there too. And one of the things that's really useful, if you want to avoid these kinds of situations for yourself, either as someone posting online or as someone who wants to work with people to promote your brand, it's called the FTC Disclosure Guidelines, an in-depth exploration of what affiliates and merchants need to know. And it's from marketingland.com. So you know it's good. I commend you to see what they have to say there. Oh, and just before we leave this topic, that one of the other, just in the flurry of information about all this, is the pitch deck for the Fyre Festival to help them raise money for the show. And if you just want, you know, humor or insight into how these things work or what a pitch deck for such a thing looks like, it's fun to look at. But one thing that caught my eye in looking at that was how, you know, we've come full circle on our very first episode of This Week in Law. We had Hank Perry on, and he was the former CEO of Napster in the middle of all of Napster's renowned legal problems. And now here on May 5th, 2017, we are looking at the Fyre Festival, and the Fyre Festival was setting the stage for fundraising and how great it would be to invest in this event by saying that that recorded music revenue is under pressure and artists are seeking new ways of earning revenue as the music industry model, business model has become disrupted. So Napster, it's all your fault. That's why this all happened. It's, you're still reaping the rewards of having disrupted the music industry. And folks on cold Bahamian islands without proper tents and beds can come knocking on your door. Just kidding, Napster. In fact, I actually tweeted that. And speaking of people who are effectively or at least ardently using social media, the social media director of Napster responded to that tweet and essentially told me not funny. That I should stick to practicing law. Humor, not my forte. All right. On that note, let's move on to some other advertising issues also in the entertainment arena. So while I was busy following all the Fyre Festival unraveling, I wasn't really busy following what's been going on with YouTube, but Franklin was, thank goodness, and let us know so that we could talk about it on the show today. It seems like there has been really a kerfuffle about ads on YouTube, and it arising out of the fact that advertisers, big name brands who are not trying to put on new music festivals, people like Coke and Pepsi and others, are under pressure to ensure that their ads do not become matched up with some of the more controversial content that one can find on YouTube. Both in the UK and the United States, advertisers have gone to Google and YouTube and said, hey, you know, you've got to do something about this. We can't. We just can't. We can't be involved in some of the people that you have on your platform. And so in an effort to try and deal with that problem, creators on YouTube has made it easier for brands to disassociate themselves with things that they believe are too controversial for their brand. And now various YouTubers who are engaged in things that aren't hate speech or, you know, terribly awful things, maybe they drop an F-bomb or two, are finding that where they were able to make a living on the channel, you know, off their YouTube channel before, that's becoming hard, if not impossible. And this all involves two restricted mode on YouTube, which is something that's available, has been available since 2010, and we've talked about it before on the show, where you can filter what comes to you. And maybe, Franklin, you can better explain how that comes into play here. Are the advertisers themselves able to say that anybody who's kicked out of restricted mode, we're not going to advertise with them?
Yeah, that's my definite understanding of it, is that the advertisers can control what types of videos their content or their pre-roll ads or their pop-up ads show on. And so that's been kind of the underlying issue here, is advertisers are opting out just across the board for anything related to the restricted mode. So, yes, that's correct.
So restricted mode has always had its issues. As a parent, I've certainly investigated and used it at various times, and found it to be useful sometimes and overly censorious, for lack of a better word, at others, or just, you know, false positives and things like that. So it's not a perfect system by any means, and people, you know, as YouTube tries to pivot to respond to these advertisers and address their concerns, various YouTube creators are very up in arms. We have LGBTQ creators who think that they are being unfairly impacted by this. And Franklin, you had highlighted some YouTubers called H3H3 Productions, who I wasn't familiar with before. But we have some video for them that from them that explains a bit their take on all of this and how it's impacting them. Maybe we can roll a bit of that and chat through it or on the other side.
H3 classic complaining about YouTube video. Got him. I feel like this video goes beyond complaining. Okay, I want to talk about the YouTube ad boycott. I feel like people, ourselves included, were hoping and holding on to the fact that this was going to get better for everyone. And I think for a lot of people, it has gotten better. But for ourselves, it continues to get worse to the point where we don't think that we can continue to even exist the same way that we have on YouTube. The problem is that YouTube, in an effort to bring brands back, has given them the tools to not put ads on anything that might seem controversial. But it's so blunt and it's so stupid that it is destroying our channel and our livelihood. Out of our last like 8 videos, we've had only one video that was normally monetized, and the other one's made pretty much nothing. So let me take you a step through here. So
Daddy okay, that's Five probably, Estivo, we don't need to go into no all ads. The detail yeah. of their videos and which made money and which didn't. But you know, it sort of tees up the issue that perhaps they're getting omitted from consideration. He called it blunt, and I think that's a good way of putting it. It's a blunt tool. It is not a precise tool, and that maybe some precision would be helpful, certainly for the YouTube creators and for the advertisers too. I would imagine that, you know, they wouldn't want to just carve out huge swaths of popular material simply because somebody had decided that one thing that they did was a little off color. So it seems like YouTube's got kind of a big challenge on its hands here. One thing, you know, that the creators need to bear in mind is that although they were given this opportunity to monetize in one way, I'm sure they were never given assurances that that would remain in place, you know, for eternity. And YouTube has, you know, definitely the ability to change the way it approaches advertising and deals with advertisers and makes advertising available to the content creators. So you're kind of, if you've decided that that is your platform, you sort of get what you get.
And Denise, if I can also add, I mean, we kind of have to remember that YouTube is owned by Google or Alphabet and whatever their corporate structure is. But at heart, that is an advertising company. They make the boatloads of money from advertising revenue. So when it comes to, as we found at the beginning of the month back in March, I think it was, when all this stuff was going on over in the UK and then has bled over here into the US from those advertisers pulling back from the channels, I think it's important to show that Google and YouTube are not going to let their revenue streams die over if they had to choose between that and then the content creators not being able to earn their living. And I liken this, and I think anybody, any attorney or just anybody, manager or whatnot, that is working with clients that are internet creators, it's kind of an important lesson to remember. And a lot of people learned this back when Amazon launched their Kindle platform, where anybody could publish and earn revenue from the Kindle platform and pricing of their books. And that model changed quickly to where people that were making hundreds of thousands of dollars in a year off of their Kindle books, self-published authors suddenly were making tens of thousands. And that's a huge – or even just thousands. And that's a huge decrease in revenue. And it was all controlled by one platform. So I think that same mentality, that mindset of, as you mentioned, making sure that your revenue is not just coming from one source like YouTube, but expanding and making sure you have other avenues of monetization of your product and not just relying on one source. And one of the ways we've seen that is like with H3H3, the husband and wife duo there, they are now looking and trying to expand to other networks and other platforms for monetizing and sharing content. And there's another video where PewDiePie, who has also been in the news recently for the YouTube Red series, where he was going to have I don't want to sound ignorant on this because I don't want to go any further with it, but I know it had to do with the Holocaust and very anti-Semitic comments or viewpoints on that. But regardless, the big creators.
Yeah, I just think of him as a Minecraft gamer.
Exactly.
But when did we get into the Holocaust?
they're leaving the platform and they recognize that YouTube or Google are going to put advertisers first. And it makes sense from a business model. But at the same time, those eyeballs, those big stars bring a lot of eyeballs without which advertisers wouldn't really care about the platform. So it's kind of a cyclical thing here. And it's going to be interesting to see what comes of this. But if you mentioned you weren't familiar with H3H3, but they've been in the news recently as well, because they have the lawsuit going on about the fair use, because they took another creator's video and basically cut it up and provided commentary on it and uploaded it to their channel. And then they got a lawsuit, copyright lawsuit, and now they're in the midst of that. So that might be another way that people have heard their name before, if you're not a full-time YouTube watcher, if you haven't cut the cord yet, or if you don't just watch a lot of videos on YouTube, that might be where people have heard of them before.
Right. Fascinating. We had a comment in IRC that then scrolled by me. There it is. It's from Reverb Mike saying, YouTube, what other source is there? Well, that goes to your point, Franklin, that it'll be interesting to see the fallout of this. There are other sources. One of them's Twitch. What are they doing?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, PewDiePie, who you know from Minecraft gaming and a lot of other Let's Play style videos, has actually moved over to Twitch because Twitch recently launched a new affiliate program, and they're bringing on partners to – and Twitch is the Amazon company. I guess to back up a little bit, Twitch is the Amazon-owned video game streaming platform where – Let's Play videos, that's the style, that's the term used for videos where you basically sit and watch somebody playing a game while they're either commentating on it or just talking about anything and everything. So there's a wide variety of Let's Play videos, but that's the gist of it. So Twitch is a platform dedicated solely to that and was bought up by Amazon. So they're actually moving and exploring avenues for bringing on affiliates so that people that are broadcasting live on their gameplays they can actually monetize it. But then also throwing into that, they're allowing if you're – so let's say you and I or somebody is watching this show right now. If they wanted to, they could comment and they could pay extra money to have their comment stay at the top longer, or they could send digital goods, like they could buy like gold, that kind of thing. And we're seeing a similar platform come up and rise in the ranks called YouNow. I'm pretty sure I might have just butchered that, but I'm pretty sure it's called YouNow. Mm-hmm. YouNow.com. And that is a very similar platform where it's all about live streaming. YouNow.com. And it's live streaming, and it does the same thing where it encourages interactions through live chat, giving gold bars to the person that it's live streaming that you have to pay real world money to give. And so that those are really great revenue sources. And I should have provided this in the show notes. So I'll send that to where it can get added. But there's a great tubefilter.com article where they break down and actually talk with internet creators about the amounts of money they're getting. And it's in the tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars for just doing like a 4-hour live stream. So it's a growing model, and YouTube is trying to catch up with features that YouTube has launched, like Super Chat, which do the same thing where you can have different fonts or colors or different amounts of time your comment stays at the top of the chat box. But the YouTube's trying to catch up there, and I think that it's going to be interesting to see what platform ends up rising to the top and what other platforms can take advantage of this these issues that YouTube is facing right now.
Yeah, that is all really interesting stuff. And one of the things that caught my ear as you were going through that was that YouNow sounds an awful lot like YouTube, Mike. I wonder if we're going to see similar everything kind of lawsuits as other people try and call their video sites you something.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, YouTube is such an iconic brand and so incredibly strong. No doubt Google would take the position that any competitive site that incorporates you, certainly as the first part of the name, would potentially be an infringer. Mm-hmm. The other thing that struck me about this whole issue with the advertisers pulling from Google, sounds like Google's going to try to enhance its process here, and which may call for more human moderation and people actually reviewing videos and so on and so forth. And if that's the case, it does raise a potentially interesting issue under the DMCA. So recall that under the DMCA, if you're an online service provider like YouTube, you are immune from liability in certain circumstances. There are certain safe harbors for you. But if you have red flags, or if you are aware of instances of actual infringement, that safe harbor goes away. So the more human intervention, the more human moderation that is used to review content that's online, you potentially run afoul of the DMCA and get put on notice about infringing content that you would then have the obligation to disable or take down. So, Google, YouTube, they're in a bit of a fix here.
Right. Do you think they could just fall back on the argument that, hey, this squadron of people were trained to look for offensive content and not infringing content?
Well, I don't know that would be completely persuasive, because after all, you are an actual individual that's reviewing content, and to the extent that you start doing that, there's a pretty good argument that irrespective of what they were trained to look for, it's right there in front of them. And if you're put on notice, if you have reason to believe that there's infringing content, even if you weren't trained necessarily, that potentially raises an issue as to whether you can still avail yourself of the safe harbor.
And that we actually had an ABA call on there's a subcommittee called the Computer Copyright and Social Media Subcommittee, where we talked about the LiveJournal case that recently was in the news. And so that exact question came up. And one of the things that I pointed out on that call, and I'll point out here, is I wonder, Denise, just like you were saying, does it matter that if you have people that are assigned to look specifically for issues with a community guidelines policy as opposed to the separate and apart policy related to content and, well, maybe content's not the right word, but the copyright and just intellectual property style policy. I kind of think that it would be to the benefit to have them kind of separate, because I know a lot of times right now, whenever you sign up for a service, it's typically just a end user agreement as well as a privacy policy, and there's no separation between the community guidelines and and that DMCA policy that you kind of see included in there. So I wonder if that would help. And Mike, it sounds like you're saying that really won't be a distinguishing factor the courts look at potentially in the future.
Yeah, it strikes me as though that wouldn't be all that persuasive, because at the end of the day, that really just allows the online service provider to say, hey, look, we told them you're only supposed to look for X. You're not supposed to be considering whether there's copyrighted content or other infringing content that might be there. It allows them to kind of cover themselves and kind of going into it, insulate themselves from a potential claim of infringement. I don't know. It seems to me that the DMCA is not calibrated for that.
Yeah, and I could see them making that argument and then the entertainment industry coming back in and saying, hold on a minute, wait, you've always said it was way too difficult and cost intensive to actually filter things using other than automated methods, but here you're doing it on this side of things, and it would just require a little more training for those people to also look for what we're complaining about, infringing infringing content on the channels, and we know that's still a huge problem, and here we're going to show you how it's a huge problem. And I don't think Google's in a good spot,
there may not be a whole heck of a lot of sympathy for that argument, particularly given how massive the revenues are that are generated by YouTube. One article I read, I think I've got this right, just on YouTube alone, I think they generated $11 billion within the last year or so. I mean, that's a massive amount here. So,
all right. So we're going to talk about infringement on YouTube in just a second, but I want to get Micah's thoughts on any of this YouTube ad boycott and how it's impacting the YouTube creators.
Honestly, I got little to nothing. I don't go to YouTube much, I'll leave it to you guys to comment on this one. So,
all right. And I guess the last thing we should say as we wrap up this portion of the show is just, the Twit Network, and I wouldn't ever want to speak for Leo and Lisa, but I've been a part of it for a long time and have watched as we have, used YouTube as a distribution vehicle, but we're not YouTube native. And I think that concerns such as what we've been discussing here probably have a lot to do with that. And, we have a totally different approach to advertising. We put our own in. Lisa Laporte has the Artisanal Agency, which is all about podcast ads and how to do them. And I guess I have to put hashtag ad with that since, Lisa puts the ads on our show. But
Denise, if I can add one more comment to that. I know that Twit they have the live stream on YouTube. And there's actually YouTube has built in, this actually was announced a couple months ago, I think, they announced that you can now, it allows anybody that's uploading content or live streaming to check a little box under the settings for individual videos or live streams and say it includes a paid promotion. And that will actually, for the YouTuber, display automatically a text down in the bottom left. You might have seen this already if you're watching videos on YouTube. It'll say includes paid promotion. So that's been a really interesting way to kind of see YouTube fall into and provide a way for creators or anybody putting video content online to disclose in that capacity.
Right. Yeah. So you know from the get-go, if you're watching something, you're complying, the creator's able to comply and let people know, hey, I'm not just getting off and or you're getting on YouTube and spouting off and
correct.
That I'm having ads associated with the show, and they may or may not be YouTube ads. Does it run either way?
So the YouTube ads would be separate. So my thinking, and I don't know, this is complete speculation, but my thinking is that if I upload a video, so I'm going to use BuzzFeed as an example, because I watch, or my wife and I watch a lot of BuzzFeed videos. And if we watch a dog video that ends up being sponsored by Pedigree or Purina or somebody like that, then it gives the creator, as I said, the option to put that notice at the beginning of the video, right when it starts, which the FTC seems to like. And then also, in my mind, I would think that YouTube might be using this so that their advertisers, they can say, hey, this video, an algorithm or something can say, hey, this video is already including an ad of some kind. Maybe we have advertisers that don't want their ads to run either as a pre-roll ad or as a pop-up ad. We don't want that to roll with something else that might include sponsored content that YouTube or Google is not controlling. So I think there are two different ways to look at that, both benefiting the content creator as well as YouTube as a platform serving ads.
And of course, everybody who uploads to YouTube has the choice not to have ads at all. And if you already have ads incorporated in your content, that might be one reason why you'd make that choice. All right. So tell us about fan subs, Franklin, and this case in the Netherlands. I think this is really interesting. I've certainly stumbled across various videos where something that I want to watch is in another language. And in order to be able to watch it, someone has put their, or to make it pleasant for someone, say in the United States to watch it, someone has dubbed it with English subtitles so that you could understand it. There was a case in the Netherlands that didn't like that. Tell us why.
Yeah, so there's an anti-piracy association in the Netherlands called BREIN, Breen. I'm probably butchering that. I apologize to any of our Nordic region listeners, but so they decided to raise some money. There's an organization called the Free Subtitles Foundation, and they decided to raise money to take this anti-piracy group to court over the use and creation of fan subtitles. So Torrent Freak was the one who had a great article about it. And then Ars Technica also put out a really good follow-up article as well. But unfortunately, I was unable to read the actual opinion because it is in Dutch. So I guess ironically, I think I tweeted this. Ironically, I need a translation or subtitles for that opinion to really understand what was going on. But from the reports that were happening, it just seems like the court ruled that it's illegal to create fan subs. So that's a huge blow to fan sub websites. And it's a very large industry, or not industry, that's kind of sounds like there's a commercial connotation behind it. But for the most part, there's a non-commercial industry and groups and community. Community is a better word. There we go. There's a large fan sub community that circulates fan subs for anime is probably one of the bigger ones that people utilize this service for. But I actually on Netflix has gotten into doing some really great content. And there's a show on there called Terrace House. That it's a Japanese show that we're, again, my wife and I are obsessed with it. And it's really interesting, but we have to watch it with subtitles. And so I actually used to watch subtitled shows using fan subs back when I had time to before being a lawyer in law school. And I enjoyed the fact that fan subs typically provide, first of all, a different translation most times than a commercial release will, but also the fact that they provide commentary related to societal norms that you might not understand as somebody outside of that culture that the video content's being produced in. So I was really drawn to this this article simply in this decision simply because I was wondering, my first question was, is there a fair use defense option available in the Netherlands? And from what I found, it's not as extensive, if at all, as it is here in the U.S. But going on to that, aside from that, I think that in my mind, there's a difference between ripping and sharing subtitles from a commercial disc that's been released in that territory. So if we're in the U.S. and somebody, Funimation, releases a TV show here in the U.S. and a community of fan subbers rip the subtitles from that and then start distributing those, that's obviously, in my opinion, very wrong and copyright infringement. But fan subs that are distributed separate and apart from the original underlying content. So without, if you're watching a TV show, without that TV show being included in what's being distributed, if you're just distributing the text subtitle files that can be added onto a video player like VLC or something, that to me is okay. And I kind of say that with the caveat of if there is a commercial version available, I would think that it'd be better to buy that and support the content creators and the studio taking the time to subtitle that and release it in the US. But if there is no commercially viable option for watching that content with subtitles in your territory, I kind of see you're not there. It takes away that element of having a commercial impact on that studio or creator, and hopefully you would support them in some other way. But that, right. Again, that all goes to not distributing the underlying content, just the fan subs. And then adding on, my last point I'll make on that is I believe that fan subs can oftentimes, as you see in that Ars Technica article that was just shown up at the top, you typically have your translation, your subtitles along the bottom of the screen, but then at the top, so fan sub communities are great about knowing their audience and giving clues. And so going back to my Netflix example, I mentioned Terrace House. There are a lot of times there are Japanese cultural things that you just don't understand and don't make sense. And so it helps to have somebody guiding you, and kind of like a tour guide guiding you along and better understanding why somebody said something or did something. And then I've never seen them incorporated into a commercially released commercially released subtitle on a disc or something.
Right.
But I'm sure
you're saying there's sort of a mystery science theater component to them, where they're adding to your enjoyment of the original content.
Yeah,
and then the other thing I'm wondering about in considering this, These are otherwise non-infringing videos, right? These aren't videos that have been, ripped from a DVD and then fan subbed. These are videos that have been made available from the actual rights holders.
So I think,
is that always the case?
Just because I'm a huge proponent of respecting copyright, I think that's pretty obvious based on the industry I work in. But I think, as I said, I think there's a huge difference between taking a disc or ripping something off of a television stream or something like that and actually distributing the underlying content with the fan subs. If you're just distributing the fan subs and there's no other way, maybe in a specific territory, to get access to those, that's where I think that this can really help. And it's doing a service. And now where that person in that territory ends up getting the video content, I would hope that they buy it from like an import, buy it some other way, and then rip it themselves and then add the fan subs back when they're playing it by themselves. But again,
who does that, Franklin?
Who does that? But that's kind of my content creator looking out.
You're living in a lawyerly dream world. On record, that doesn't happen.
I can dream. but I think the main reason I say that and I make that distinction is because I do think that it is very important. If you're watching and enjoying a show of some kind, it's important to support the creator. And so whatever that might be, support the studio, support the creator, regardless of I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, so the case that was in the Netherlands, though, did it involve something that had been ripped and so was infringing in the first place, and that was part of the infringement problem? I could see a court wanting to come down differently on this if there is content that's made available only in Japanese from a Japanese rights holder, but it's available worldwide and only Japanese speakers can enjoy it unless fan subs are added. I could see a court wanting to come down differently in that kind of a situation, but
that's why in this particular situation, I wanted to be able to read the actual court opinion because I couldn't understand from the news articles. From what my understanding is, it doesn't seem like there is an actual specific issue. It's more so the community of the Free Subtitles Foundation going ahead and preemptively challenging this and trying to get a ruling in their favor, not based on a specific instance. Although it appears to be a community of subtitlers that are sharing and distributing these in some capacity.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating. It's a little bit different than the entertainment industry model of releasing in different theaters so they can geographically control. And of course, if you're releasing in a country that speaks a certain language, you're going to make sure that the customers in that country can either read subtitles or have it dubbed. But here, you know, you put something on YouTube, it's available worldwide. And it doesn't seem like necessarily every content creator, rights holder would take that into account, thus teeing up the problem that you've presented here, Franklin. Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, it's really interesting from a copyright standpoint. I totally agree with Franklin that there is a very large distinction with a meaningful difference between ripping the CDs or ripping the CDs or whatever and adding the fan subs and then redistributing that. That would clearly be an act of infringement that's not authorized. But this other method is intriguing. If I understand it correctly, Franklin, that it would be an existing video that the video player would somehow be keyed to have these fan subs run underneath at the bottom of the video. Interesting question as to whether that's a derivative work that's been created. Given that you actually haven't copied the underlying work, you're just superimposing the fan subs. But I do think that there would be a fairly significant fair use argument here. You know, you're providing this service, this fan sub, so people can understand the video and that's providing some meaningful assistance to consumers. It sounds like some of these groups are nonprofit or they're doing this without charge to consumers. Is that right, Franklin?
Yes, that's my understanding. The main reason and the main way this all came about is because there's no commercial incentive attached to these groups of fan subbers. And like you said, it's important to note there that with fan subs, it's going to be important for the subtitles to actually work properly. You're going to have to designate whether a fan sub is created, that file will work with an official rip of the video. So if you take a video source and you rip it, if we're in the US and I buy a Japanese Blu-ray, I have it shipped to my house, I rip it hypothetically, and I rip it on my computer, and I have the video file straight from that Blu-ray. Theoretically, that would be the exact same file for anybody else that did the exact same thing. And so the fan sub creator would then time and create fan sub files for that particular recording. Where you get kind of different results are, and like in anime, for instance, the anime fans that watch the shows, they want to keep up with the show as soon as it airs on television. So you're going to have people BitTorrenting the anime episode that is ripped from the broadcast network station that it was released on or aired on that week in Japan. And so if I'm a fan subber and I'm creating a fan sub for that version, whenever that product actually gets released on Blu-ray or DVD, the timings that I created for fan subs on that particular episode, because it has a different runtime, it's not necessarily going to work on when the commercial product is finally released and you can actually obtain a legal copy of that particular program. Does that make sense?
No, you completely lost me.
Me too. It sounds very complicated.
So I guess the biggest takeaway is to know that when you're watching, when you're using subtitles, timing is everything. So the actual way that subtitles are created, it has to be timed properly so that the subtitles display on screen at the same time that that person or character is talking. So if you're watching a video source that's been recorded and is not the exact same length, runtime, the video is not the exact same length, then you're going to run into issues of the timing aligning up properly.
Right. Folks in IRC are talking about whether region coding plays into this at all. And Reverb Mike points out that you can burn a DVD with no region. But if anyone is still burning discs, he says. I think it does impact your – it doesn't impact your ability to put – fan subs with the video, I guess. It would impact your ability to actually use a DVD if you're using a player that doesn't have the right region coding, right? That's how that would come up. So if you're gonna gonna go through the process of making yourself a copy of what's on your legally purchased DVD and then add in the available fan subs, you would have to have the properly coded DVD player to be able to do that. Yeah. Okay, got that. No one does that is going to be our first passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these passphrases in case you are a lawyer or other professional who likes to listen to our show for professional credit in your field. If you would like some more information about that, head on over to wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there. If you're a lawyer, we've got the various jurisdictions and links to their various forms. You did that, Franklin. You did that, right? You made this chart for us.
Yes, I hope it's been updated.
We are still using your chart. We are not updating Franklin's chart. So you might find some dead links there, but it's at least a starting point. You should know that we are not an approved provider in any jurisdiction of the United States because the hoops to jump through for that are rather extensive. But if you would like to go through the process, yes, and the cost too, and the various applications, and it's just they don't make it easy. You can go ahead and apply on your own and pay a small fee that would be far less than, you know, what most MCLE programs, that stands for Mandatory Continuing Legal Education. They can be kind of costly. So if you like our show and you want to make use of the fact that maybe you can get some credit in your jurisdiction, we're all for it. Go for it. Let us know how it goes. We'll help you out however we can. So no one does that. One of the ways we help you out is we put these fast phrases in so that if you're watching or listening, you can demonstrate that you did so. Some jurisdictions like to see that. Yes. So, Micah, anything on fan subs?
You know, I was sitting there thinking, I kind of disagree. I think the fan subs would be a derivative work that's infringing. Because I think it definitely would just create a mark or, you know, the industries or the people who control the copyrights for these different shows and anime might be waiting to kind of build up a pent-up demand before they go into this market. And so you're potentially, you know, affecting their profitability by making the dubs or the subs available later down the road. So I think in my mind, it's pretty clear derivative infringement. That said, I get where Franklin's coming from, where some of these subs with more cultural context could be very handy, because I in fact had a Japanese house guest stay with me for a few months, and we would watch foreign television and we'd pause the show so he'd give me context of what's actually happening, because the joke didn't make any sense to me. So I get the benefit to that, and I had a live-in translator for it, but I still think it would be a derivative work that would get some people in trouble.
Right. And maybe there's a parallel here. In our family, my offspring likes some various series of Japanese light novels that are published in Japan and originally in Japanese. And they eventually get published in English, but it takes a while. So like what Franklin was saying, you know, if you're a huge fan, you don't want to wait around for it. But, you know, that's what we do. We wait until the English publication, because who's going to go through and translate a novel and then make it available? And that would, I think, clearly be infringing, certainly if they were selling it. So, you know, as far as I know, if that's happening, it's not something that I think people avail themselves of. I think they wait patiently or impatiently for the English translation to come out from the actual publisher. So, you know, I mean, maybe that's what the, rights holders would argue should happen, with translations of the works that we're talking about for the reasons that Micah just mentioned. What do you think?
Adding to what Micah said, I think it's also important to note that a lot of distribution companies could also use this data of how many people are actually downloading fan subs in a particular territory. And honestly, I agree with Micah. And if you're in the US or an English-based territory, you're going to have a harder time arguing that you're not impacting the commercial viability of the product, because you're more than likely going to have an English version of that product at some point. Whether it's immediate or later on is a whole different story. But I think that there's a lot of data that could also be mined from the number of downloads or the number of fan subs that are made available for content, because that kind of lets you know as a distributor, like, you would want to know, like, is it going to be worth our effort to put all the marketing and promotion and all the effort and time into creating the official subtitled version of a show in a market? And that right there is access to all the data points and demographic information potentially that you would ever want to know before you enter into a market. So there could be a benefit there, but I completely agree with everything Micah said.
All right. So I think we're going to move into, we haven't had any good discussion of augmented reality video games in the law for a while, since Pokemon Go sort of became the thing that not everyone was playing anymore. But I'm not ready to let go. I so enjoy discussing Pokemon Go and augmented reality and the law. And Franklin, you've given us the opportunity to do it again. So that's what we're going to do. And we're going to look at the policy considerations around that. So I'm letting you drive the bus here, Franklin, since you have sort of two groups of stories, one involving Pokemon Go and its privacy policy, and the other involving a permit in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So which one should we take first?
Let's do the lawsuit first. We like that. Right. Or I guess we're both lawsuits. Let's start with the Beckman Niantic story first, the Pokemon Go lawsuit. So this lawsuit, Beckman v. Niantic, and Niantic is the development company that was a spinoff of Google Labs. And so it was a mapping company, and I know we've talked about it on the show before. So if you want the whole history of Pokemon Go and Niantic, go watch another episode or multiple episodes of This Week in Law from the past. But Beckman
v.
Niantic
was a complete episode back in our archives that is all Pokemon Go law. So
exactly.
fill yourself up on it. Yes.
Yeah. So without getting into all of that, let's just start with the lawsuit and assume you have an understanding of what Pokemon Go is. So there was a lawsuit filed actually July 26th, 2016, and it was a whopping 20 days after the game had launched here in the U.S. So Beckman is the plaintiff in that lawsuit. It is a Florida gamer that sued Niantic, alleging the service's terms of service and privacy policy are deceptive and unfair, and that they were violating the Florida Deceptive and Unfair Trade Practices Act. There is an acronym for that, but I'm not going to even go there. And therefore, they were unenforceable, is what Beckman was arguing. So in the complaint, Beckman claims he unknowingly shared private and personal information with Niantic by playing the game, thereby allowing Niantic to collect user data. So fast forward, not much was happening. And actually, the CLE panel I did back in April, which we'll talk about in just a minute, at that point, this case was not much happening. But then earlier this week, we finally got an update on one of the first Pokemon Go lawsuits filed. So a judge signed an order on Monday of this week saying that Beckman lacked standing because he failed to show that he was actually injured by the alleged violation of the terms of service and policy. I think one of the biggest holes in this case is that Beckman was trying to argue Niantic could freely change its terms of service and privacy policies. However, the judge determined that hadn't happened yet, and therefore Beckman had not been injured. So classic standing issue here. So in addition to the Florida lawsuit, Niantic, in their argument, claimed that Beckman didn't have standing to bring the suit under Florida law because the user agreements required litigation to be brought under California law. The judge agreed with this and ultimately held that Beckman was unable to overcome the California choice of law provision, noting that even if the case survived under Florida law, that Beckman failed to sufficiently state a claim under the Florida Deceptive and Unfair Trade Practices Act. It was actually, there's a Law 360 article that contained a quote from Beckman's attorney. And Beckman's attorney said that the Monday order leaves a window open for the lawsuit to continue by allowing the attorney's client to amend the claim. So perhaps this isn't over yet, and we can talk about it on a future episode of This Week in Law.
It sounds like there may have been something that Niantic was doing with its privacy you mentioned something about the ability to update the privacy policy. Of course, people can do that as long as they give notice. Was there some sort of implication right. that Niantic didn't have to give notice, or what was that bit of it?
It's kind of confusing. Well, I mean, one of the mm-hmm. early issues that we saw with Pokemon Go was the Google sign up. They were under heavy fire, and a lot of watch groups were pointing out that by signing up for the service, which you could only do through either connecting your Google account or mm-hmm. signing up with an email address, it was basically giving full permissions and full access to your Google account, at least from the screen that was displayed. Niantic and Google actually came back to say that although that screen was displayed, Niantic had limited information. They were just using like an old, API is not the right word, but the token access they were using to mm-hmm. utilize Google sign-on was just an old version, and so it was mm-hmm. displaying incorrectly. So that kind of mm-hmm. went away. But in this particular lawsuit, I don't really understand that because, as you just said, first of all, the judge points out like the Niantic had not even changed anything on the policy at this point. So why was the lawsuit mm-hmm. even being brought? And was it being brought just for the fact that Niantic could potentially do that without warning and unknowingly telling users? I don't really understand. You would think a company like Niantic would have.
We have to get into the head of the plaintiff and why he filed the lawsuit, and that's hard to do.
Yeah.
But exactly. Yes. But interesting. I was just wondering if this sort of gave Niantic a heads up that, hey, you know, you might want to tweak your privacy policy in this way because it could lead to a suit down the road. But it doesn't sound like it sounds like the only takeaway here is, hey, if you ever do change the privacy policy, be sure and give adequate notice or someone might sue. So
correct.
Hopefully they already know that.
Yeah. And then also the only other thing with this case is I think the California jurisdiction issue is going to be one, a pretty heavy hurdle to overcome too, for obvious reasons.
Right. Any thoughts, Micah?
Not so much, but I do have a question for Franklin. Mm-hmm. What level of Pokemon Go trainer are you? I feel this is relevant to the case.
I'm opening it right now. I am a lowly 21 or 22. I think as Denise said, I have stopped playing. So
I got just that far too, and then stopped playing. I never made it to 30. Did they ever make it so you could go past 30?
Oh yes. You could definitely, I think you can go higher than that. I haven't been to any local gyms to see recently, but, so here we go. It looks like I'm at level 21.
Yep. Mm.
I like it.
If you can see.
I like it.
There we go. Are you Team Mystic?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Of course. Absolutely. I can barely remember that I was Team Mystic. All right. Further augmented reality related stories await us. And this is something we did discuss on our show that was all about AR games and specifically Pokemon Go. I believe we talked about this Milwaukee, Wisconsin requirement that people get permits for where you could play augmented reality games. This was a permit requirement, if I'm remembering properly. They wanted Niantic and others like them to get the permits. So they got sued for that, right, Franklin?
Yes. So it was an attorney named Brian Wassum is representing Candy Lab AR, which mm-hmm. is a I think we have a link to show their website, but it's a company that creates augmented reality games. And I'm blanking on the title of their most popular one. It's something like Hold'em, some type of Texas Hold'em, but Texas Rope'em. That's what it's called. Mm-hmm. So the game developer for that particular game. They actually decided to sue at the end of April, file a lawsuit against Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, because of, as you talked about before, the city ordinance that requires game developers to obtain permits if they offer virtual and location-based augmented reality features to players. So Candy mm-hmm. Lab is basing a lot of their argument on the First Amendment. And so it's kind of interesting. There are a lot of different points to talk about, but one of the most interesting, I think, is the permit application, which is actually 10 pages long. And it, among other things, it requires that companies releasing the games go through this this review process. So there's actually going through this review process does not even guarantee that a game developer will be granted permission. A second kind of issue that I've pulled out is that a game developer has to submit an insurance certificate that has $1 million policy attached to it. So like of general liability coverage, which I'm assuming most game companies would have some type of general liability insurance policy, but whether it has to be specific to covering this particular county, who knows? But then the other interesting aspect is Brian Wasson points out is that the company has to make it available for on-site inspection. And all the other wording, if you look at that 10-page document, all the other wording kind of more mirrors what you would expect for a company or an individual that is hosting a singular event that is happening at 6 p.m. on a Saturday at your local park.
Right.
So that's kind of the permit. That's the way that the requirements read to me, not like an ongoing blanket permit for gamers that they would be playing or walking around in this park. But then on top of that, you also have the fees that are required for the permit. So it just seems like an extreme burden to place on game manufacturers, especially if this type of law and ordinance requirement would expand into other counties, especially with the, like I said, the revenue attached to that for the permit fees would be, I mean, if I'm in a county and I'm helping to run and oversee the ordinances for that, why not take advantage of this opportunity to have an extra income generated by all these augmented reality game developers or just augmented reality developers, whether it's a game or not? Why not jump on that opportunity to have that extra income coming into your community? But at the same time, I think it's from a logical standpoint, it's just a very extreme burden to kind of put onto game developers.
Right. That's really fascinating. It'll be interesting to see how they do with their lawsuit, where it goes. It was just filed, right, in late April, you said?
Yeah, exactly, towards the end of April. And Brian Wasson, he's the attorney on LinkedIn. He's the attorney for the plaintiff, Candy Lab. And there, he has a great LinkedIn, which I think we're going to show here, great LinkedIn article that kind of runs down all these issues. And he's been blogging about this topic for a while. Yeah, there it is. He's been blogging about this topic for a while. And the First Amendment issues that come into play. And in the article, I think it's interesting how he points out that video games have been deemed speech by the Supreme Court and therefore are fall under the First Amendment protection. And he also argues for it's a prior restraint. So one other interesting point on this whole thing is that from some news articles I read, it seems like the Milwaukee County Parks actually wrote a letter to Niantic asking for a couple of the Pokestops within their parks to be removed. And it, without any other comments, I guess game players have noticed that the Pokestops have disappeared from the game. So that's another interesting aspect to this whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, imagine we won't go through the process of becoming an approved MCLE provider in all 50 states. Imagine if game companies had to obtain permits like this in every city where they have players. It's just untenable. So very interesting. It'll be cool to watch where this goes and how Mr. Wasson does with his lawsuit. And again, you mentioned that you and Micah did a panel all on Pokemon Go and augmented reality recently.
Oh, I wish Micah had been on that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we were
both at the same conference.
Mike was at the conference. And
that's right. You guys had you had selfies together and all. I forgot all about that.
Oh yeah.
I was getting my mics and my mic is confused. All right, good. Yes. So Tell us about your panel.
It was a panel. Every year the ABA, their section of intellectual property law, it's a mouthful, puts on a spring event called IPL Spring, and there's the video as you can see, and it is a conference where IP attorneys come and present on topics. So I got the opportunity to put together a panel called Legal Compliance, I Choose You, and it was basically examining augmented reality. And virtual reality, mostly augmented reality issues, legal issues through the perspective of Pokemon Go. So as you can see there, I filmed the entire panel with a 360 camera, and shout out to Ali Camera is the camera that I use, because in my research I was running into issues trying to find a 360 camera that would actually record for longer than 30 or 45 minutes without overheating. And as you can see down there, this panel was an hour and a half long. So luckily the Ali Camera, which is designed mostly to be the version I used, is mostly designed to be a home video monitoring camera, turned out to be perfect for what I needed. And so I had it plugged into a laptop, which I covered up with that logo from the ABA down there that you see. But so I edited this video in Premiere and added these little graphics so you could see some of the slides that we're talking about. But on the panel there, we have in-house counsel for Wargaming America, which is does World of Tanks. You might have seen their Super Bowl ads with the little mini houses getting destroyed. It's hysterical. we also have an attorney from Venable, Kimberly Culp, and then I'm messing up because I'm going to forget people's names, but Jimmy Yoon from Oculus VR was also on the panel. And we had John Polito from I am blanking on his firm's name, but either way, we had a great panel, and I think that there's a lot of great information in there. After viewers watch the Twill episode where we talk about Pokemon Go, this would be a great follow up and supplement to that. So
absolutely, thanks for sharing. Yeah. It's so cool. You opined in our rundown that you think you might have done the first CLE event ever recorded with a 360 degree camera, and it's likely that you did. That's really cool. And
everybody
yes.
wants to watch CLE in 360, right?
Well, yeah, you've got to look out at the audience, see who's awake and who's asleep, and I'm really more interested in how IPL's marketing strategy worked when they put you and Mike on a boat and had you playing with pigs on a beach. And stuff. Did that draw a lot of people to the conference?
We'll work on that for next year, making that actually come around.
Right. We'll make sure to disclose all those material connections, though, for sure.
Good. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yes. And on this video, I actually uploaded this to the ABA IPL's YouTube channel. I actually did click the box that it includes a paid promotion, because I guess technically we are promoting the Ali Camera. So I did make sure to check that box. Whether or not like they're not paying us to, they just gave us a camera for free, but still it's somewhat sponsored, I guess.
Oh, yep. Free product. Yep. It counts.
Yep. Definitely. There's a benefit.
I would say so. All right. Mike Keyes, anything to add to this revamping of our AR law and video games discussion, or revisiting, I guess, is more what I meant to say.
The thing that struck me, and of course I'm not a First Amendment scholar by any means, but in the article that I read about the county officials reviewing these various apps and games, apparently one of the criteria or what they'll screen for is the appropriateness of the app. Anytime that you have government officials opining on the appropriateness of the app, whatever that means, you're well into First Amendment potential violations here. So I did read the complaint also. It's quite a good read. So kudos to the gentleman that filed that complaint. Should be interesting to see how that'll plays out.
Yeah. Interesting sort of on topic, off topic, related topic comment from Bleep Blurp in IRC mentions that Pokemon almost died off because of the add-ons that were blocked that allowed cheating. And I very much remember that time in the game's history when it used to be, fairly seamless and a good experience to play. And then all of a sudden things just stopped working.
Denise, yes. Were you one of the Wi-Fi walkers?
No, I don't think so.
Have you heard that term?
No.
Basically, you would turn off and on your Wi-Fi network on your mobile device or tablet, if you loaded on a tablet, I don't even know. But you would turn off the Wi-Fi and it would cause your character to move around because it would think that it was trying to connect to different Wi-Fi points. But either way, really random.
I think it was unintentional. I think I remember times when my character was running around aimlessly and I had no idea why that was happening. So that could have been it. But it's sort of a good point, just related to the fact that, you know, obviously game manufacturers have to try and block cheating in all manners of ways, but players are still going to try and do it. And if you're going to block what they're doing, you can't break your game, or it may wind up being a bad thing. Micah, anything to add?
Not really, but that law is very interesting. I gut check tells me that it's not going to last very long, either by a political pressure or by that lawsuit. But, you know, it's a good, considering what was happening back in last July, I can see people writing laws and doing things to, you know, try to corral some of what's happening. In my neighborhood, you had rent-a-cops next to a shopping complex walking up to people who have been standing around looking at their phones for more than 5 minutes saying, "Are you playing Pokemon Go? You can't loiter. You got to keep moving." And if you're calling an Uber or something else, they'd want to see your phone to say, right, "Oh, no, I'm just calling an Uber. They'll be here in a second." So I can see this kind of, you know, now that that fad has leveled out quite a bit, I don't see this law sticking around too long.
Yeah, interesting. Mike, anything before we move on?
Nothing further here.
Nothing further here. All right, then let's go to our favorite of the bumpers, the most ambiguous of the bumpers, the other bumper. That one's not yours, Franklin, right? That Sando made that work.
I wish I could. I wish I could claim that. I was just thinking. I wish I had thought of that, but oh well. Great job, Sando, though.
Yes, thank you. So, Micah, I have. I'm not sure what sort of recidivism that Ascivilate, am I saying that right? Is supposed to address.
I think you're saying it right. It's It's a relatively new company that I just recently found out about. It's based here in Atlanta, but they've come to the legal industry from software and other technology, and they're trying to solve recidivism. They're trying to figure out a way to keep people who are on probation from going back to jail. And they've taken an approach of, we have to solve this from a process standpoint with current technology. And they've looked at, you know, what factors and what reasons are people getting nicked for parole violations and going back? And they've realized a lot of it is kind of nitpicky stuff where, oh, they missed a meeting, they didn't make an appointment, and they forgot to tell the parole officer. And they're trying to find ways to better solve those problems, make sure everyone's communicating and on the same page through a system or an app that a parolee can use, that connects to their parole officer, it connects to other things, so they can show that, you know, they're trying, they're working on it, they're getting better, and there's no reason to really, you know, say there's a parole violation and put them back in jail. And it's an interesting system and an interesting approach in that they're trying to solve a real social justice problem for people who don't necessarily have the financial resources and freedom and ability economically to take off of work, to go to certain meetings, in a way that's an actual business. So you see a lot of different programs and through the ABA and local bar associations who are trying to address these type of problems or create apps and other tools that are you know, volunteer work or nonprofit, but they're trying to do it in a sustainable way that's economically viable, and so that they can spread it and roll it out to other places. And it's not something I've seen a lot of. And so while they're very new and they're kind of untested and they're just starting to get clients here in Georgia and other states, I like the idea of what they're trying to do that's effective to reduce the amount of money spent putting people back in jail and having, you know, these problems reoccur, and do it in a way that is economical for them and still saves local government's money and helping, you know, lower income individuals, you know, stay out of jail and helping their lives. So it's a very interesting thing that I have not seen this kind of app created before, or this kind of business model that's trying to do both a social justice type thing and be economical while they do it.
Yeah. Well, we wish them well. I guess my reaction is kind of a little bit our first MCLE passphrase, no one does that. I'm wondering, you know, what their uptake will be. You know, if you're responsible enough to have a calendar app, maybe that would suffice for you and maybe a Silivate has some specific aspects that makes them more tailored to this situation. So I, not knowing much about it, I certainly don't want to run it down, and they have a very worthy goal, it sounds like. So thanks for bringing that to our attention. And it is a super interesting way of addressing a legal issue through a technology. So that's one to keep an eye on. And that's a lot of what you do in your consulting practice, right, Micah? You look at how technologies can sort of tackle things that the legal industry has tried over the years and conventionally to tackle without technology.
And that's right. And while I do basically consulting work, I work for just one law firm doing stuff internally for the one law firm. So I'm not actively consulting to different clients. Mm-hmm. And while I'm an attorney, I'm not technically an attorney for this law firm, as my mm-hmm. disclaimer, you know, sure. here. And, but it's true. There's a lot of law firms out there of varying sizes who are technology adverse, and to have to look at a problem that's really process of technology specific and figure out what technology is going to be beneficial to make things more efficient so the law firm can be more profitable or reduce costs for the client is something traditionally lawyers have not been good at. And mm-hmm. a lot of my role is looking at a problem, hearing complaints from attorneys going, I have a problem, go fix it, and figure mm-hmm. what process of technology can be used to help solve that problem and make it better. And, you know, there are a few tools we use that are AI related, but I think that's a very young technology still. A lot of what we're doing is very kind of common sense. It just never has reached the legal industry with legal mm-hmm. project management, matter tracking, pricing analytics. Yes, law firms are starting to use math in some of what they do to set a price or analyze their processes, but it's still relatively new for the legal industry, and it's exciting that we're trying to change to be a better entity and not just, you know, increase our rates every 6 months because, hey, we need more money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's something that, you know, we've done lengthy shows on AI in the law and various interesting technologies that are going to intersect, not just with the legal field, but with lots of businesses as well, and take conventional practices and make them, as you say, more efficient and cheaper to deliver. And that's something certainly the legal field needs some help with.
Absolutely.
Yes. All right. So let us move on to our animal selfie of the week. We have a lovely one for you to go out on a Friday before a nice weekend. Without much further ado, we'll just play it. I don't believe we may have had seagulls before, but this is a good one. I don't know if it has volume or not, Kara. There we go. Yes, I think volume helps it. So the gull has taken someone's GoPro on a lovely sunset afternoon in San Francisco and literally flown off with it. Didn't dump it in the ocean, apparently, but dumped it nearby. There's more to it, but the owners of the GoPro, I see that there's the selfie portion. We actually, the gull was actually not just the cinematographer, but also the self photographer. So it it qualifies on pretty much all rungs of our animal selfie test.
Okay, well, Denise,
how
do we
took
know?
The video and was featured in it. Go ahead.
Now, how do we know that is actually the bird that was doing the selfie? I mean, that could be another, his companion or something,
just
right?
A flyby gull.
Yeah.
It could be. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Could
just
be
want to point that out for the record.
That, absolutely true. And then the owner of the camera runs in at the end and snatches it back up. So the camera was not taken too far away from them, thankfully. But yeah, that gull has a serious history a serious history, if it does. I'm not sure what that is, but possibly a future of bay sunset photography in it to pursue.
I think, I think it's fair to say that that gull has a lot of gall.
Ah, definitely. Any gull that takes your GoPro has a lot of gall. Our resource of the week is an exciting one. Mike, you have a new book.
Yes, we do.
Tell us about that.
Yes, it was announced at the conference that Franklin and I both participated in a few weeks ago in Washington, D.C. It's called Copyright Litigation Strategies. It was many years in the making. There's about 35 different authors that contributed to this work. I was one of the co-editors along with Dale Sandale. She's a partner at Kirkland & Ellis in New York. And it's a really great resource. It has about 30 different chapters on all facets of copyright litigation, starting with the demand letter phase all the way through appeal. So it was a labor of love over the course of probably 10 years, as you can imagine, with about 30 different lawyers participating. It's that is the definition of herding cats, getting everybody together, getting all of the articles written or all the chapters written. And then it went through a series of updates over the years and then peer reviews. And finally, we pushed it across the goal line, and we've been really happy with it. And the ABA was a tremendous partner in putting it together and getting it published. So we're thrilled about it.
That's fantastic. Copyright Litigation Strategies, available from the ABA. And for those of you who are waiting for more ISP privacy policies as our resources of the week, keep waiting just a little bit longer. I'm going to get to the next one very soon. But in the meantime, I have a different privacy policy. This one's going to form more of a tip of the week this week to look at. And I'm looking at this one because a relative of mine gave me this product. And so I immediately, of course, went and looked at the privacy policy. So I've actually looked at this one. It's not terribly lengthy. So I can tell you about it a little bit more easily. I could actually find it, which is something that most ISP privacy policies make a little bit difficult, especially trying to find the right one. And the reason that I bring up this one is it sort of has that same problem in a different way. You can find the privacy policy. This is for Tello years. A relative of mine gave me this product, and you may have seen their ads on TV or elsewhere. And they are... they have a technology where they look at your telomeres, which are the bits on the ends of your chromosomes. And if they have degraded a lot, that's not a good thing. It means that your cells are older than they might or should be in actual years. So it's something that it gives you information about, you know, how you can you should be worrying about reducing that. That's a good oxymoron. Worrying about reducing stress in your life if you have shortened or degraded telomeres. So that's what their science says anyway. And, you know, if you're interested in taking this test, you might also be interested in how they deal with your data. So the privacy policy issue that they have is you may not quickly find the privacy policy that you're really interested in, which is the one that tells you how they're going to deal with the information that they take from your blood. The one that you can quickly get to and digest is their website policy, website privacy policy, which talks about cookies and the various things that website privacy policies generally talk about. It talks about COPPA, things like that. This is really kind of a UI issue. So that's why this is a tip. It's a twofold tip. Number one, if you are a person who wants to take one of these tests that gives you data about yourself and your health, and you're not getting it, you know, directly from your medical professional, but from a company like this, you're going to want to find their privacy policy and see what it says. And you're going to want to know that the website privacy policy is different than the one that you may actually be interested in. That's the same with the ISPs, cable companies, et cetera, too. They often have a separate website policy, but then a whole different policy that deals with the data related to your viewing or your use of your cell service or what have you. So be aware that you might need to look in a couple of places. And this one, my tip for the actual companies involved here putting their policies out there is you might want to pay more attention to your UI and how you present where your two separate policies are, because you can quickly get to the website privacy policy here, but then you're presented with text that's not bold and has links that aren't blue or really bright at all. They're sort of this dull sage green color. And you might just blow right by the fact that there is a protected health information privacy policy where you have to click a different link and go to that. And that talks about what they're going to do with your blood. And they seem to have some responsible language there that should assure you if you're interested in what they're going to do with your stuff. They are not selling it to third-party advertisers, as far as I can tell. So that's a good thing. So our tip related to TeloYears and other similar privacy policies, look for the right one. And if you are the company, present it in a way that folks can find the right one. And Franklin, you had an additional tip for us about hackathons.
Yes. So I know that you have a largely wide variety of people that listen to the show, everybody from attorneys all the way to non-attorneys. And so I wanted to share this resource I have that's mostly geared towards attorneys, and it's called Every Attorney Should Participate in a Hackathon. Here's Why. It's a bit of shameless self-promotion because it's an article that I wrote. But Micah actually introduced me to the Music City Legal Hackathon that was the very first time Nashville had a legal hackathon event that was connected back to a nonprofit global organization called Legal Hackers. So if you go to legalhackers.org, I talk about this in the article, you can actually find local hackathons that are happening in your area all around the world. And so it's a great way to get experience into understanding if you're wanting to learn more about development work, what goes into coding and finding solutions that involve technology and coding to reach that solution. This is the best way to do it. And what's really cool is that pretty much any hackathon event is centered around what they call stakeholders, which are essentially nonprofit organizations within a local community that have some type of need, as I was saying earlier, technology can solve, a need that technology can solve. So that is where the developers come in, and also where attorneys come in and other professionals, whether it's professors or marketing team, whatever your experience is. I really kind of learned that no matter who you are, if you go to a hackathon event, you'll find a way to plug in and help in some capacity. Whether you're just a user of technology, you can kind of help guide the discussion on how UI or user design might do best. So that's kind of the whole purpose of that, was to kind of shed light on what hackathons are and how pretty much anybody can get involved in them, especially attorneys.
Thanks so much, Franklin. Poor CRL in IRC is saying that he has pulled out all his telomeres by the roots, or she. I'm always guilty of making those assumptions about people's genders in IRC. I'm also guilty of not putting our second hashtag into, or second hashtag, our second passphrase into the show for CLE purposes. Gulls with gall, I think, will do nicely, Mike, for that.
All right.
Purpose. Yes. And with that, I think we have gone ahead and wrapped up this show. Thank you so much, guys, for joining me this week. It's been really, really fun. Great discussion, lots of interesting topics, and I've really appreciated your thoughts and insights. Mike Keyes, great to see you again.
Always great to see you, Denise, and great to be with Franklin and Micah today. This was a lot of fun.
Yes, it sure was. Franklin, wonderful to have you back on the show, back in the family fold just for a little while.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's always so much fun being on this show, and I love talking about a wide range of legal issues. So thanks for having me.
Yes, great to see you again. And Micah, great to meet you. We really appreciate your joining us.
Yeah, thanks. It was fun for my first time. It was great.
Great. I'm just going to ask all of you, if anyone wants to chime in with anything that we haven't discussed that's going on with you that you'd like folks to know about, now would be the time to say your piece. Going, anybody? No, I think, what? Somebody? Nope. Okay, then we'll go ahead and tell you, thanks so much for joining us for this episode of This Week in Law. We record the show on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC. So that's when you can join us live and play along in IRC if you'd like to do that. We're always grateful for the folks who join us live. It's great to interact with them and hear what they're thinking while we do the show. But if you can't do that, don't worry about it. Our whole archive of shows, including those on AI in the legal industry and elsewhere and on Pokemon Go related law, are there for your viewing pleasure. If you go to twit.tv/twill, that's where you'll find all the shows going all the way back to 2006. And again, you can see how we were talking with Hank Barry back then, and Napster still comes up in our discussions. What else should you do? You should check out that page to determine how you might want to enjoy the show. There are all kinds of ways to do it. Watch in the gym, listen in the gym, or while you're out still playing Pokemon Go and blowing way past level 30. All kinds of ways to watch or listen to the show, or if you're just kicking back on your couch, a Roku might be the way to go, or however else you connect to the internet and watch things on your big screen. Anyway, on our twit.tv/twill page, an assortment of options are there for you. If you're still an iTunes subscriber, thanks so much for that. We do appreciate it if you leave us reviews, and we're not going to take anything off your bill if you do so, because there is no bill. This show is totally free. You know, if out of the goodness of your heart, you want to chime in and tell us what you think of the show, we do appreciate that, either in iTunes or on YouTube or wherever you enjoy the show. If there's an ability to leave us your thoughts, we'd love to have them there, or you can email us. You can reach Mike. He's mike@twit.tv. I'm denise@twit.tv. And Matt, our other co-host, is mattc@twit.tv. So reach out to us. Let us know what you've thought of what we've covered, other things that you'd like us to cover, other people you'd like us to reach out to possibly have on the show. We're thrilled to have your thoughts and really appreciate interacting with you guys between the shows as well. And you can do it on social media too. You can find us on Twitter and also on Facebook. Good places to catch up with us there. We will be dark next week, but never fear. We will be back the week after that, and we're looking forward to seeing you then on the next This Week in Law. Thank you.